Africa, India, and other countries. For more information, call 337-1500. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the internet and how it shapes the way that we think about what we know about the past. I think it's true that every time a new information technology has come along, people have said, well, this changes everything. And by giving us greater access to information, this will change the world. And certainly people said that about the internet. But then people said that about other things that came before the internet, like television and radio and microfilm and the printing press, for that matter. Just how much do these information technologies shape the way we think about the past and give us access to information about the past? Well, these are some of the ideas that we'll talk about in this part of the show. And our guest for the program is Jeffrey Bowker. He is Regis and Diane McKenna Chair and Executive Director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Society at Santa Clara University. And he's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk on this very subject as part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Center on the third floor on the U of I campus. Of course, these events are always open to the public. Anybody who wants to attend should feel welcome to stop up. But he's been good enough to come here with us and be with us, as many of the other speakers do, to bring the subject to a larger audience, many more people than probably could attend the actual talk. So, of course, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're welcome. you're also welcome here to join the conversation by calling. The number 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Can you talk a little bit about your larger interests and how this, because you are, I guess it's correct to say you are an historian of science, right? Mm-hmm. And you're interested in many sorts of different things. How does the internet connect with your larger sort of interest?
My central interest for a number of years has been the development of information infrastructures and what difference does it make that we use different media to present, to describe our information in. You gave a very good example at the start of the printing press. It was said when the printing press was first developed, now we can talk to the great and good of all ages. We can talk across the generations. We can sit at the same table as Plato and Aristotle. And it was also said when the printing press came in, well, there's a certain way of presenting knowledge and a way of presenting information that goes along with the book. It's a very linear form. You start here and you go through to the end, unless, like me, you cheat on mystery novels and start at the end and work backwards. You have the medium itself makes a difference to the way in which we understand knowledge, understand information, understand the world around us. What I've been particularly interested in for the last several years is looking at the internet and all of the changes that go along with the development of the internet, because I think it's a genuinely revolutionary new medium. I mean, it's of the order of the printing press. As we develop this new medium, how is that changing the way we think, and how is that changing the way we appreciate the past?
Yeah. I think that's interesting to think about that because the internet is sort of like and yet unlike what has come before, in the sense that it combines some elements of other kinds of information technologies, and yet there are some things about the internet that are unique. Let me just start out with a very big and broad question. Well, in what ways is the internet different and influences the way we read, we think, we exchange information?
Sure. I think one of the revolutionary things in the last 10 years, revolutionary developments, has been the development of Google, which is an amazing technology. It gives you random access to information which you have just left traces of in some institution, in some space. I used the analogy in the old days. I used to visit a lot of hostels in weird far-flung places in the world, and I would leave my name in address books here and there. And basically, that was lost information there. No one could ever come back and, you know, kind of, that could never come back to bite me that I visited that particular hotel at that time. Mm-hmm. Now, that sort of information is so easily available. I've got a good friend I was just talking about coming to Champagne with the other day, and he was saying, well, he's actually rather upset because whenever he types his name in on Google, what's called ego surfing, when you look for your own name, what he finds is the second entry that comes up is his darts record in Champaign-Urbana, where he came. He has a 0-2 record in darts. And he really wants to change the representation of himself. But his past failure, his past embarrassment, Dennis is his name, is really, it's there for everybody to see. Your past, you can't escape your past in ways that you used to be able to with some of the other media. I think that's one of the huge changes.
Uh-huh. I think the other one of the other things that, that maybe people are concerned with is, well, it's true that we now have access to a vast amount of information. There are, along the way, there are people who are determining what information we will have access to, and that there are questions to be asked about when you do that kind of search. Mm-hmm. Why is it that certain things come up and that other things that might don't?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And that's Google have actually been, the specific case have been fairly good about this, but it's a constant battle between the folks who are trying to get the information out there in front of you and get their web pages ranked and get their information as number one, and the people on the other end who are trying to produce just and fair search engines. And it's always going to be a struggle. And right now, there are certain things about the internet which remain unjust and remain inequitable on a global scale. Most web pages are still in English. Most web pages are still being produced by white males. It's new media, and this is very common in history with new media. When writing first came in as being trusted in Europe in the 12th century, we went from women's history, where women would tell the story of families, to the monks' history, where the monks would write the story of families. So at the same stage as we get a change in medium, we get either an increase in gender divide or a new gender divide coming into play about who controls, who puts out the information. In essence, it's hard to control. It's hard to control what information about yourself goes out there and stays out there, and it's very, very hard to make certain that the landscape itself is fluid enough for multiple points of view to be properly represented.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose, and again, this is not a revolutionary observation, but that also there's a problem with misinformation, with disinformation, with information that's there that's not correct, and sorting one from the other, or if there is something there that needs to be corrected, having that corrected, very, very difficult.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's I did a capstone course when I was teaching at the University of Illinois a number of years ago called Literacy in the Information Age. And one of the precepts of that course was, well, in the old days, we used to know about books. You pick up a book and you can tell this is a respectable publisher or not. You've got that information. You've got the quality of the paper itself as information. The typeface is information. What's on the back blurb, you know, the back cover is information. All of that together means that we're actually very sophisticated from a very early age in judging books by their covers. We're not very good at judging websites by their covers or websites by their presentation. And that's a new set of skills that we have to learn. And I think they're totally learnable, and the skills, and we can learn to deal with this information in a sophisticated way, but we need as a society to develop the ways of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the promises that were made early on about just how democratic a medium the internet was going to be, that is that everybody could get on, everybody could have their own website, everybody could be their own historian, and everybody sort of had equal input, it hasn't quite turned out to be that way yet. Was that too much of a promise at the beginning, or is the issue that it's just something that one has to give it time?
It's a fabulous question. I'll give two answers for it. First is, it's the sort of claim which is always in the proximate future. It's always just around the corner. And it always seems to be possible that we will become our own best historians, that we will be the producers. Various attempts to take over the internet and turn it from being more of a democratic and sharing medium into a push medium where programs were coming out. Attempts like that have failed, and I think that technology is more or less that technology has failed. More individual technologies are coming into being all the time, like podcasting, for example, mm-hmm. which I know WILL does, which allows you to send out individual radio shows automatically downloaded at various sites and so forth. The problem right now for me is more the problem of there's too many people producing their own histories and their own information. If you go out on the web right now, scrapbooking is one of the huge developing technologies, which is teaching people how to produce their own scrapbooks, digital scrapbooks, which are fabulous. But whoever has the time to read them, whoever has the time to go out. So in a sense, we're awash in a sea of memories, and we're awash in a sea of representations of the past. But deciding what you're going to read and what you're going to devote your time to, it's a whole other issue.
Yeah. I think we have a call here on our line number 4 in Indiana. We'll start right there. Hello. I'm not hearing anything. Well, okay. Maybe there's a little bug in our system. Maybe we got to check with the caller again to make sure that they're really there. Okay, let's try again.
Right.
Line 4. Oh, yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When you first talked about this, actually before the news break, I thought the person on the other end was going to make some epistemological claims about the computers and things. And I guess not. We're still just talking expansion of data. Is that true?
Depends on what you mean by epistemological claims. I mean, I'm totally happy to make some, but...
Well, go ahead.
Okay. All right. It's putting me on the spot here. The main question about the nature of knowledge, the main question that I see arising in our knowledge about the past, which is developing in the internet, is that the internet itself marks the start of a new archive, the start of a new moment in history, from which point on we will be creating a certain kind of record, which will be a continuous record. We're basically moving into an era of history before the internet and history after the internet. Now, as we're making that move, we're in the process of developing some pretty interesting social and organizational characteristics to make that possible, but which have an effect on the nature of the past that we're representing. Let's give a simple example. In the old days, people wrote email messages fairly freely because it felt like such an informal, such a natural medium. Right now, especially when Gates got in all the trouble at Microsoft because of internal memos at Microsoft, which indicated they wanted to crush their competition using unfair business practices, now people are much more careful about what they write in email. So they're writing their email with the idea of the audience already in mind. They're curating the history that they are leaving for us on the internet and in this totally accessible form. So at the same time as we're getting this flood of information, we're getting a flood of information which is modulated in certain key and interesting ways along political organizational guidelines. That's giving us new ways of accessing the past. If I want to access... an example I'm going to use in my talk today is the 3rd of March, 1999, for no specific reason. I can bring up 1,000 things that happened on that day, pictures from that day, people who were born then, this incredible flood of information. But that flood of information in and of itself is skewed in certain fairly interesting and fairly fairly direct ways by the ways that we have of managing large websites, managing information flows, and treating our own data. So that's very broadly that leads to a claim about what's the nature of our understanding of the past that can emerge from the internet. What were you thinking of, sir?
The caller rung off, so I'm not sure if that gets at what he was thinking. If he wants to call back and talk with you some more, he can do that. And, of course, anyone can, too. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, by the way, Jeffrey Bowker, is Executive Director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Society at Santa Clara University and is here to give a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon on the U of I campus dealing with some of these very same ideas. Well, I want to go back to something that you mentioned in response to the caller, which I think is interesting, and that is if you go back through history, you can find examples of individuals who were very conscious of the fact that what they were doing was speaking for the future in some sense. They had this feeling that what they were doing would be remembered and that people would read that when they were gone and that would influence how the people in the future thought about them, the writer, and what was going on. Mm-hmm. But certainly not everyone did that. A handful of people did, but not everyone. Now, are we getting to the point where, in some way, everyone is thinking about the fact that almost whatever they do does become part of this enormous historical record?
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's a totally fascinating move. One indication of that, which is a very sad one, which I saw just the other day, was a series of snapshots that some people had taken just before the tsunami, this Canadian couple, where you see them, first of all, there they are by the swimming pool, and then there they are, they're looking out over the beach, and they're taking pictures one after another, and you see, first of all, a drawback of the wave, then this massive wave thundering in over them. Now, the interesting thing is that at no point do they stop taking pictures. Just drop their camera and run. It's integral to their experience of the moment that they should be recording it. And it's that act of recording. I don't know if you saw the movie Core, which is quite an amusing science fiction movie, but it's got a bit where Stanley Tucci at one point, he's about to be blown up by a nuclear bomb for reasons you don't need to know. But as he's about to be blown up, 2 seconds before, he's still recording into his personal tape recorder. And it's that kind of active recording which seems to have gone, in many ways, out of control in our society right now. Out of control, not in the sense that I don't think it's creative and useful and fun, but out of control in the sense of there is no possible readership for all of this material that we're producing.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is not going to be, it wouldn't be worth reading even if there was. I mean, how does that get at some issue of quantity versus quality with the amount of material that somebody or other has seen fit to produce?
Well, you're appealing to my old archivist tendencies there. And as an archivist, everything can be valuable. So, I mean, I'm delighted that it's all out there. We haven't as a society thought very well about how to preserve it. When books on acid-free paper will last you, 400 or 500 years and still look pretty darn good. CDs, we don't know if they're going to last, 20, 30 or 40 years, but they're certainly not going to last a couple of hundred. So how exactly we'll carry this information forward is unclear. But that it's there, I'm sort of happy that it's there. I'm sort of worried that we're spending too much time thinking about future representations of the present as opposed to just living in the present. So I'd like us to be doing a little bit less recording just on those grounds. But for future historians, it's great that it's there.
Yeah. Well, though, if people are as they're doing their recording, so conscious of the fact that someone in the future is going to read it, and that they're editing as they're going, then you're really not getting an accurate representation of the past. Then.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, you are getting skewed representations. The fact that you've got so many of them, and if you take there's a whole different array of things we're talking about here. If we're talking about individuals collecting information and giving out information, then often the confessional nature is quite amazing. I mean, if I go to one of the memorial sites, there are a number of memorial sites out there on the web where you can record impressions and memories of your loved ones. And you can kind of add in sound, and you can add in visuals, you can add in film. Those sites can be remarkably intimate. There are things that I would not think about sharing. Probably my own English heritage, but there's very little that I would think about sharing on the web about myself. Mm-hmm. But people do, and we're changing in it. And I think that's that's grown up with the medium. The fact that we have become a more confessional culture is partly due to the fact that we now have technologies that can record our confessions so much better and can broadcast our confessions so much better.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, when I think about the process, in 1970, I was working on a dissertation, and my God, I mean, the effort, and, you know, I think I had to, you know, go up to the University of Michigan and, you know, get those dissertations and, you know, mail them back. And you know, today, with Windows and research on the Internet, and, I mean, I just think it's too easy.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This is one of my favorite facts out of library and information science is that if you tell people that the electronic card catalog has 60% of the records that are in the library, whereas the card catalog itself has 100% of the records, most people will choose the electronic. Because it's easy, it's there, it's just the touch of the fingers, you get the references that you need. What you're missing out there, of course, is just all of the hidden stuff, which gets more hidden by the fact that it's not yet represented on the net and not yet represented in the electronic frameworks. Now, there used to be the argument, and I think it's much less so now, there used to be the argument that, you know, we couldn't really browse, we couldn't do the serendipitous stuff on the web that we can do in bookstores or in libraries. And I think that's not true anymore. If you go to Amazon, for example, right now, you can go inside books and you can browse books as much as you would browse them, probably many more than you could browse in a bookshop. And you can find out who's been citing a book. So you can actually find out, you know, who's been writing about this author that I'm really interested in, where does it appear, and you can actually go in there and find it. So actually we are getting some nice electronic models there, which I think are allowing the sort of more leisurely information search and the richer information search that you're speaking of from the 1970s.
Well, I think I just view that there was a lot of dead ends I had. You know, you'd get the sources and all that kind of thing, and you'd sort of get into them, and, you know, you ordered them from other libraries and all that, and it didn't even come close to what you needed. The old method, you know. But anyway, thank you for the comment.
All right, thank you.
Other comments and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something else I guess comes to mind, I think about going back to the time when the main way for people communicated was writing letters, and mm-hmm. people kept journals and put down an awful lot of things on paper. Mm-hmm. And then how many, in some cases, I don't know how many, in some cases people said to someone close to them, said, at my death, what I want you to do is burn everything. Now, and of course, historians, archivists, people like that, they just tear their hair out at that because, of course, that's the material that then they later use to do research and write biographies and so forth. But there have been some people where that's been accomplished. Maybe somebody said, no, I'm not. I think it's important that this stuff survives. But then there are cases where, in fact, somebody was faithful and they did that. They chucked everything into the fire. It seems that we may be coming to a point where that simply, it won't be possible anymore. You can't say, oh, when I'm gone, erase my record.
No, that's right. That's right. That's really interesting. It's, I'll reach back into the internet in a minute, but just on that historical example, letters used to be such a different medium too. When I was reading several years ago the archives of Charles Babbage, who was one of the people who created the first difference engine and then the analytic engine, which were the forerunners of the modern computer, mm-hmm. Babbage would be in correspondence with his friend Charles Lyell in London 4 or 5 times a day. You know, first of all, do you want to come to dinner tonight? And Lyell would say, yes, what shall I bring? And Babbage has got time to respond. And there were 4 deliveries a day in central London. So it was much more like an email correspondence than what we would understand an epistolatory correspondence to be. Then historians go through what we consider was the dead years, and that's when people stopped doing their dirty business using letters, and they started using the telephone. And telephones don't leave traces. And then the internet came in, and it's like, wow, maybe we're going to get it all again. And as I was saying a few minutes ago, well, we're not really getting it all again. What we're getting is a fairly modulated version of it. But yes, you can't get rid of the past. I love occasionally going to the Internet Archive Project, which I hope some of your listeners know about, where if you go visit the Internet Archive site, you can get the internet as it was at various different years. So you can see previous versions of your own website, things that you would have been ashamed now to have representing you are out there for historians, and there's nothing you can do about it. You don't own the information that you're putting out there in the same way that you own your letters or you own your manuscripts. I mean, when Kafka's letters were destroyed, that was it. If Kafka's emails, if he'd been writing email, no way you can destroy that.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk again with someone here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, I have a couple of points I would like to hear you talk about. You mentioned the time and effort in doing papers when the fellow with the dissertation was talking about, you know, and you hear about old generations, grandpas talking about walking 5 miles to school in the dead of winter, but did they learn anymore? Or you'll hear about Lincoln reading Shakespeare and the Bible in his little cabin down south of here. And myself, I certainly walked 5 miles between the various libraries of the university writing research papers when I was there. Now, the question comes down to, is the glass or the catalog half full or half empty? You mentioned, you know, that 60% of the stuff might be in the electronic catalog. And you made it sound as though you were only interested in the 40% that was empty. Well, any process, as it's going from 0 to 99%, you can't really say they hit 100, goes through a phase where it's half empty or half full. You got the digital divide, you got the catalog divide, you got the question of how many books are in your library. Any advance in technology, even something as simple as driving coast to coast, allows one generation to skip over what other generations saw, and the previous generation can then say, well, you didn't really see it because you fly from coast to coast. You have no idea what's in between. You didn't really see it because you didn't walk all those miles from book to book in the library. So the question becomes, it isn't any increase in technology going to allow the next generation to do it with less effort, and then the current generation is going to say, oh, it's too easy.
Yeah, really good point. I'm not in favor of us all going back to days of walking 5 miles to school through the snow. I don't think that's fun for anybody, and you know that's not particularly useful. If there's one thing I'm concerned about with the ease of information nowadays, it's somewhat different, and the concern, I don't think it's a conservative concern, although I might be challenged on this. Increasingly at university, I'm finding I'm dealing with students who do not read any books cover to cover. And the old, you know, the older model that we would squirrel ourselves away in a library and actually sit down and work with a book and really go through it from beginning to end. Now, that's not the only model for producing knowledge, but it's one very good and one very rich way of experiencing knowledge. Increasingly, students are much, much better at making links. They can make links incredibly easily between this subject and that. They can jump from site to site and get – it's a different way of knowing and a different kind of grappling with information and data structures. So, yeah, I mean, it's not only that things are getting easy, the old things are getting easier, which I'm delighted about. I mean, Google is coming out with this thing now, putting the three major research libraries, was it Michigan, Harvard, and what's the
Oxford.
New York Public Library,
yeah.
I think, yeah, up on the web. That's fabulous. And that will make life so much richer for people who, you know, in rural communities who had no access to this information, no access to these books before. That's incredibly rich. What's troubling is, if it's too easy to get the superficial and to skate from here to there and not have the discipline to actually get down and dirty with the books, that worries
there,
me.
There, I want to argue with you.
Okay.
You use the term superficial in what I consider to be a very derogatory manner. I would like to assume that when libraries are choosing what books to catalog and when they're choosing what books to put on the internet and all the rest of the decisions that, that we hope librarians are making that they get paid for, that they are trying to give us the best possible return on the effort and to provide us with those materials that have the most meat on the bone as opposed to the least meat on the bone. And I, if I were forced to use your term of superficial, would have to say it's the bone that has the least meat on it that's the most superficial. It's the bone that only the ivory tower iconoclast is going to be interested in and say, I know this, and none of the rest of you know it, therefore I am the greatest authority on this subject. to me, you've got to start where the meat is.
Well, that's right. You've got some projects like the Gutenberg Project, for example, which have been marvelous about putting classic works, making them freely available on the internet. I think that's a huge benefit and a huge bonus. And yeah, I mean, the fact that some obscure stuff doesn't get up on the web as quickly, that's not in and of itself a critique of the web. I think you're absolutely right. There's long-term strategies. The question is, as we are making this strategic move, as we are deciding to make our information basically available in an electronic form, are we thinking carefully about what we're saving, what we're not, what we're presenting and what we're not? And I think there are arguments to be made that there is definite skewing that's going on in the web right now. I mean, the web has been one of the finest things for completing the imperialism of the English language. So much more information is available in English that it forces people into English, which for me that's great, but not necessarily for people all over the world. Now, on the derogatory superficial, you're right, and I shouldn't have used it, and I can't say I was using superficial in a non-derogatory sense because I don't think it's got one. I think what I meant there was there are ways of handling the data that you're playing with which are more about making connections and cross connections than are about burrowing down into what's really going on in the argument here. What is the author trying to do? That's a different way of knowing. It's not necessarily a worse way of knowing.
I think we've been traveling in that direction all along. When I was first in school, they didn't talk at all about interdisciplinary studies. It was one of the new buzzwords. And I think you're right that it's a different way of knowing, but you can put a puzzle together by knowing the outline of all the pieces and not knowing the detail of all the pieces. There are subjects that you can jump to make an interdisciplinary conclusion that outpaces any way you could do by mastering each piece by itself. The example that comes to mind in recent history is Craig Venter with the Human Genome Project, where the old guys from the Watson and Crick era, Watson himself was head of NIH, as I recall, and he was insisting on plodding through the entire human genome one base pair at a time and lining them all up and then trying to figure out what they did. Whereas Venter wanted to do something else and was forced to basically leave for 6 years because nobody listened to him. And then he came back from his surfing expedition and bought a gene machine and said, now that I've got this machine, I can show you how it should be done. And his idea was what you would call superficial. Sorry to throw this at you like that. But literally, his idea was like that, where he said, we should go after the expressed genes, and there is a code that says to the gene, turn on and now do something. So you could actually hunt for that code and then analyze the gene that comes after it. And then what he did was to nail down all of the expressed genes before then going after all the genes. You get these huge, long codes in the genes that are totally, they're not meaningless, but they're meaningful to a bird or a dinosaur or a frog, but they're in our gene code, and we don't really need to use them other than that we have gills for a moment while we're in utero. So, sorry, I'm going off a little too much there. But the basic idea is that we can do amazing work with interdisciplinary stuff. That sounds superficial when you look at each individual piece of the puzzle, but then you get the whole puzzle put together faster, and then the people with the microscopes and magnifying glasses can come along and go into marvelous detail. I guess it's just a matter of choice. From my point of view, I'm not saying that your way of doing it is wrong. I'm just saying that there's two ways to tackle problems like that.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And I think especially when you're dealing with very complex systems, I think this kind of interdisciplinarity is absolutely key.
Where's your speech this afternoon?
It's
at the Levis Center at 4 o'clock.
Do I need an invitation?
Nope.
Well,
anybody can go.
Consider yourself invited.
I happen to do something with Project Gutenberg. I was very surprised that you mentioned it.
Oh, really?
My name's Michael Hart.
Oh, I look forward to meeting you this afternoon, hopefully.
What floor?
Third floor.
Third floor, 4 o'clock.
That's right.
Thank you very, very
All
much.
Right. Well, for anybody else, maybe I better just do that again. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Jeffrey Bucker, is Executive Director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Society at Santa Clara University, and will be speaking about the past and the Internet this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. This is part of the MillerCom series. They're always open to the public. There is no charge for admission. Anybody can turn up and hear what the speaker has to say, and he'll be giving his talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. It's on West Illinois, third floor. And for this program here, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just real quick, something that's been here in my mind, a point to raise. You talked about, for example, the efforts to take the contents of certain libraries, digitize them, put them on the web so that anybody who has the Internet access mm-hmm. can get at that. And there have been projects like the Gutenberg Project, for example, where they're trying to essentially do that same thing, mm-hmm. Make it possible for people to have, through the computer, access to a library if they don't have one down the street from yeah. where they are. The problem is that there's no – well, it seems like the problem is that there's no way that we can put everything into this – if we're assembling an enormous digital archive mm-hmm. that people can access through their computers, mm-hmm. we can't put everything there. There's got to be some point that you have to stop. So then the question is, what happens to – what do we lose? Do we lose anything if we fail to digitize and put into the archive certain materials and that either they become extreme – you know, again, very difficult to get at. It's not like mm-hmm. nobody can get at them, but they become difficult to get at. And maybe eventually they pass away. Mm-hmm. And that's assuming that we can find some way to maintain the digital archive so that it doesn't fade over time. But you know, are we losing something if we're going to a different medium of storing that information?
Yes. And every time we go to a different medium, we lose material, we lose things. When we went from the oral traditions to the written word, we lost a lot of the epic poetry and a lot of the techniques for telling and retelling epic poems, which was so richly developed in many parts of the world. When we moved from writing to the printing press, again there are certain losses that are made alongside of the incredible democratic potential of the printing press, which actually brought vernacular languages, made them much more accessible, made writing accessible through the vernacular languages to a much greater group of people. But we also lost stuff as we were doing it. As we're moving on to the Internet, somebody has to have the time to scan material in. Someone has to decide this is worth scanning in. The institutions that we're doing the most scanning right now tend to be the richer institutions. There's less concern now about keeping local knowledge. If I'm in a library in a kind of very small town, say southern Illinois, why would I bother building a large collection of my own or maintaining my own collection very carefully if I can get basically all that I want available on the Internet? It's It's a longer-term danger, but it's the danger of the loss of local collections and the loss of local knowledge that I think we are undergoing that right now.
Another caller here, Bloomington, line number... Well, no, that person seemed to change their mind. If we did that, we're sorry. You can call back. Otherwise, anybody who's interested, we have about 15 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in going back to an earlier point, because you talked about the fact that with every time a different kinds of information technology comes along, it influences the way that we take in and look at that information. That, for example, once we got to books, that it sort of forced people into reading the page a certain way. And, you know, you start in one place and you go this way, and you turn the page and you go to the next one, and you start at the beginning and you're supposed to start at the beginning and go to the end. And it encourages a very sort of linear kind of page to page to page to page to page way of going through. The internet is very different than that. And if you think about looking at the screen as reading a page, the way that you read the page is completely different. Information is all over the place. There's no standard way. There may be links so that you could jump from one place to another place to another place. And I'm sure that some people would say there's something to be said for being linear. Being an old analog guy, I guess I kind of think that way. And maybe other people would say, well, you know, yeah, there are different ways of processing information, different ways of reading and thinking, and one is not necessarily better than the other. They're just different. What do you think about that?
that's a difficult question. It's the old ways of representing knowledge, and I'll talk a little bit about this afternoon, but from the Enlightenment, we tend to think of knowledge as more or less having a tree form. You know, that there are there's the roots that are stuck in the ground, and, you know, there's the right and the sap there somewhere is mathematics, and then we've got the physics and the chemistry growing out of that, and the biology, and finally the social sciences and the human, you know, and the humanities. So we've got, in essence, we've had very singular, very linear ways of describing our own knowledge processes, and very linear ways of defining various disciplines and what disciplines do. I think the caller who brought up the case of interdisciplinarity was actually right on there. What we've seen with the arrival of the internet, and I think it's no accident at all, is the rise of postmodernism and the postmodern sort of movements, where postmodernism is much more interested in making connections across areas, across disciplines, across bits of text, scraps of text from here to there, and much less interested in the linear analysis. I think that the linear analysis is incredibly useful for as a way of training ourselves, as a way of thinking about the world. There has to be a way in which we kind of burrow down into the material that we're dealing with. And I worry about the associations that we make with the internet have the danger of being like the magpie collecting in the nest. I mean, there's all these bright colored things that I can pick out, and sure, it'll look very pretty, but will I be fundamentally changed? Will I be altered in my way of appreciating the world through this pretty presentation? Yes, if it's very well done. As in when new ways of expressing knowledge, new ways of playing with knowledge appear on the internet, this is going to be a slow process. My best example here is the printing press. After the invention of the printing press, it took about 150 years for footnotes to develop. Now, we can't imagine books without footnotes right now in the academic world. We need the footnotes in order to judge the validity of the book. We don't have that sort of a thing in place. There are many, many technical, social, organizational things we need to work out until we can express the full potential of the web. I think it will revolutionize how we think. I think it is revolutionizing it. But I think we've got a long way to go before we're there.
I think we'll try that Bloomington caller again. Here are line number four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
I have two questions about sort of the presentation of knowledge, sort of different track. One, I was wondering what your opinion is of, I'd read recently in Wired magazine about the new design of the Seattle Public Library, where they've taken all their materials and they're working on digitizing them, but the sort of the physicalness of how the architecture was built is they have this giant six-story spiral staircase. that has all the books in place ranked, you know, using the Dewey Decimal System. Mm-hmm. And it's built in such a way that as more books get added, they can expand that area so they don't have to shift everything up. And that sort of gives people a much easier way to actually physically get to the books. And also another question about the presentation of information. Books on tape have always been popular, and many times with, you know, New York Times bestsellers and things like that. Do you think that you see with the popularity of, like, iPods and the emerging of podcasting of lectures, do you see, like, academic books and other such resources as not only going on the Internet but being available in a digital audio format for people to be able to, you know, eventually one day go to a library, download, you know, whatever textbooks they would need, and then be able to review those, you know, as they would need for their research or for their schoolwork?
Okay, great questions. I'm not going to give a good response on the Seattle Public Library because I've really not read about the description. That sounds like a very interesting design process. I think the problem that public libraries are going through right now is actually getting people in there reading the books because I think people want to be at the screens a lot more. The Dewey Decimal System, I'm not certain is going to be around all that much longer, but it's been a remarkably robust technology over the last 100 years or so. Yeah, I mean, I think this sounds great because I think physical access to the books for me is central. I mean, Charles Lamb wrote a famous essay about this in the 17th century. The actual feel of the book, the smell of the book is really central. Trivial pursuit fact for those of you that are interested is the word anthrax actually. Anthrax was originally called librarian's disease because anthrax used to be passed in the glue that was used in the binding of the binding of the books. Sheep's blood was used, you know, it can be a hairy profession being a librarian, but it's still, I think, a very central one to our society. Books on tape. I mean, the point is, this all happens together. Let me give you a quick example here. I know we're running a little bit out of time and it's a number of calls, but a quick example. When in the 1980s, the Australian telecom company came out with this huge thing about telephones are what keeps the family together. It was sort of true in a sense. I can phone my grandmother in England using the telephone. Isn't that marvelous? But by the same token, telephones are what drove us apart. It was because the telephone technology was developed that we were able to kind of move away from our extended families and feel okay about it because we could stay in touch with them. So in similar ways, you've got the internet interposing itself in our lives in very interesting ways. One of the things with all the commuting that we're doing right now is that books on tape are becoming a central part of our culture. I can't imagine, I've got a 50-minute commute to work every day. I can't imagine doing that without some very good books on tape. Currently, it's a complete reading of The Remembrance of Things Past, which is about 60 cassettes, I think, but I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, I think academic books will come online, iPods and podcasting. I think it's absolutely the way to go because basically what we've been doing as a society is working out more and more ways of consuming information all the time. I think that's probably a bad thing. I wish we had more empty time when we weren't consuming information, but the fact that the facility is there is pretty amazing.
All right, thank you.
All right, we'll try and get at least one more. This caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I'd like to understand what you mean by 150 years to get to our first notes to books. I mean, some of the very first books were almost entirely footnotes. The editions of Ovid, of Catullus, of Virgil were printed with the text in the center. And almost the entire folio was covered with notes in the margin. So, I mean, you can go and check our library. We have a beautiful 1966 reprint of 1485 book, which I use regularly, the Bible, the Biblia in the Vulgate, with lots and lots of footnotes. So could you explain what you mean?
Yes, I absolutely should, especially with a good challenge like that. The Incunabula, that's the books that were produced soon after the invention of the printing press, did have marginalia and they did have extensive notes. I was thinking of bibliographic footnotes, which give place, date,
our sources,
and name of publisher. So actually, what happened was in the early days, you would get references like, you know, kind of just some vague reference to, you know, Ovid X or whatever, but it was no use at all if you wanted to trace back the book. We now have this thing, which is, you know, I think it's totally superfluous on the other side right now, where I can't publish an academic article or a book without saying where all my sources were actually published. And I don't think we really need that information anymore, but that's the way the book, that the footnote developed. And I think it's actually been a very useful technology.
Yes.
But great question. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, thanks.
All right. Well, I think we're just about the point that we're going to have to stop. And my apologies. We have one more caller that we cannot take. That person, however, is here locally. And so I want to tell everybody who's listening, if you hadn't been listening earlier in the program, everybody who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana, that our guest, Jeffrey Bowker, will be giving a talk on the past and the Internet. This is part of the MillerCom series and will be this afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the Levis Center on the U of I campus on West Illinois, third floor, 4 o'clock. It's open to the public. Anyone is invited to attend. Our guest, Jeffrey Bowker, is the executive director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Society at Santa Clara University. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. The broadcast today made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Brownfield Sports, Stickland Insurance, and Field of Greens. Also, today the broadcast is made possible by, in part, by 10,000 Villages. Their 13th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental Rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Tuesday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informational seminar about Oriental rugs will be held at the store. For more information, you can call 352-8200. Just a quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the continuing crisis in Darfur in the Sudan. Our guest there will be John Heffernan, Senior Communications Associate with the group Physicians for Human Rights. And then at hour two, we'll talk with writer Leah Hager-Cohen about her book, Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight, which is in part about the perhaps small but growing interest of women in boxing. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week, and we, of course, always welcome your calls and comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned, because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host, and she will take you here through the rest of the afternoon with news and other things, including another hour in of conversation and opportunity to call.
That's right. And our topic today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine will be prostate cancer. Our guest will be David Bostwick. He's an MD, and he is lead editor of the American Cancer Society's Complete Guide to Prostate Cancer. He'll join us at 1:06 Central Time this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 334, that up 10 and 3 quarters. July, 348 and a half, up 9 and a quarter. March corn, 213 and a half, up 2. May, 222, up 1 half. July, 229, up 1 and a half. December, 240 and 3 quarters, that up 2 and a quarter. March beans, 611, up 13 and a half. May, 617 and a half, up 13. Make that 618, up 13 and a half. November beans, 617 and a half, up 9 and a half. March soybean meal, 181.80, that up 360. March oil,